Chapter 44. Almayer propped, alone on the veranda of his house, with both his elbows on the table, and holding his head between his hands, stared before him, away over the stretch of sprouting young grass in his courtyard, and over the short jetty with its cluster of small canoes, amongst which his big whale boat floated high, like a white mother of all that dark and aquatic brood. He stared on the river, past the schooner anchored in midstream, past the forests of the left bank. He stared through and past the illusion of the material world. The sun was sinking. Under the sky was stretched a network of white threads, a network fine and close-meshed, where here and there were caught thicker white vapors of globular shape. And to the eastward, above the ragged barrier of the forests, surged the summits of a chain of great clouds, growing bigger slowly, in imperceptible motion, as if careful not to disturb the glowing stillness of the earth, and of the sky. Abreast of the house the river was empty, but for the motionless schooner. Higher up, a solitary log came out from the bend above, and went on drifting slowly down the straight reach. A dead and wandering tree going out to its grave in the sea, between two ranks of trees motionless and living. And Almayer sat, his face in his hands, looking on and hating all this. The muddy river, the faded blue of the sky, the black log passing by on its first and last voyage, the green sea of leaves, the sea that glowed, shimmered, and stirred above the uniform and impenetrable gloom of the forests, the joyous sea of living green powdered with the brilliant dust of oblique sun rays. He hated all this. He begrudged every day, every minute of his life spent amongst all these things. He begrudged it bitterly, angrily, with enraged and immense regret, like a miser compelled to give up some of his treasure to a near relation. And yet all this was very precious to him. It was the present sign of a splendid future. He pushed the table away impatiently, got up, made a few steps aimlessly, then stood by the balustrade and again looked at the river, at that river which would have been the instrument for the making of his fortune if... dot dot if dot dot dot, what an abominable brute, he said. He was alone, but he spoke aloud, as one is apt to do under the impulse of a strong, of an overmastering thought. What a brute, he muttered again. The river was dark now, and the schooner lay on it, a black, a lonely, and a graceful form, with the slender mast starting upwards from it in two frail and raking lines. The shadows of the evening crept up the trees, crept up from bough to bough, till at last the long sunbeams coursing from the western horizon skimmed lightly over the topmost branches, then flew upwards amongst the piled up clouds, giving them a somber and fiery aspect in the last flush of light. And suddenly the light disappeared, as if lost in the immensity of the great, blue, and empty hollow overhead. The sun had set, and the forests became a straight wall of formless blackness. Above them, on the edge of lingering clouds, a single star glimmered fitfully, obscured now and then by the rapid flight of high and invisible vapors. Almayer fought with the uneasiness within his breast. He heard Ali, who moved behind him preparing his evening meal, and he listened with strange attention to the sounds the man made to the short, dry bang of the plate put upon the table, to the clink of glass and the metallic rattle of knife and fork. The man went away. Now he was coming back. He would speak directly, and Almayer, notwithstanding the absorbing gravity of his thoughts, listened for the sound of expected words. He heard them, spoken in English with painstaking distinctness. "Ready, sir." "All right," said Almayer, curtly. He did not move. He remained pensive, with his back to the table upon which stood the lighted lamp brought by Ali. He was thinking. Where was Lingard now? Halfway down the river probably, in Abdullah's ship. He would be back in about 3 days, perhaps less. And then? Then the schooner would have to be got out of the river, and when that craft was gone they he and Lingard would remain here, alone with the constant thought of that other man living near them. What an extraordinary idea, to keep him there forever. Forever. What did that mean, forever? Perhaps a year, perhaps 10 years. Preposterous. K. keep him there 10 years, or maybe 20. The fellow was capable of living more than 20 years. And for all that time he would have to be watched, fed, looked after. There was nobody but Lingard to have such notions. 20 years. Why, no. In less than 10 years their fortune would be made, and they would leave this place, first for Batavia, yes, Batavia, and then for Europe. England, no doubt. Lingard would want to go to England. And would they leave that man here? How would that fellow look in 10 years? Very old, probably. Well, devil take him. Nina would be 15. She would be rich, and very pretty, and he himself would not be so old then. Almayer smiled into the night. Yes, rich. Why? Of course. Captain Lingard was a resourceful man, and he had plenty of money even now. They were rich already, but not enough. Decidedly not enough. Money brings money. That gold business was good. Famous. Captain Lingard was a remarkable man. He said the gold was there, and it was there. Lingard knew what he was talking about. But he had queer ideas. For instance, about Willems. Now what did he want to keep him alive for? Why? That scoundrel, muttered Almayer again. Macon Toon, ejaculated Ally suddenly, very loud in a pressing tone. Almayer walked to the table, sat down, and his anxious visage dropped from above into the light thrown down by the lampshade. He helped himself absently, and began to eat in great mouthfuls. Undoubtedly, Lingard was the man to stick to. The man undismayed, masterful and ready. How quickly he had planned a new future, when Willem's treachery destroyed their established position in Samber. And the position even now was not so bad. What an immense prestige that Lingard had with all those people, Arabs, Malays and all. Ah, it was good to be able to call a man like that father. Fine. Wonder how much money really the old fellow had. People talked they exaggerated surely, but if he had only half of what they said. He drank, throwing his head up, and fell to again. Now, if that Willems had known how to play his cards well, had he stuck to the old fellow he would have been in his position. He would be now married to Lingard's adopted daughter with his future assured splendid. The beast, growled Almayer, between two mouthfuls. Ally stood rigidly straight with an uninterested face, his gaze lost in the night which pressed round the small circle of light that shone on the table, on the glass, on the bottle, and on Almayer's head as he leaned over his plate moving his jaws. A famous man lingered, yet you never knew what he would do next. It was notorious that he had shot a white man once for less than Willems had done. For less? Why, for nothing, so to speak. It was not even his own quarrel. It was about some Malay returning from pilgrimage with wife and children. Kidnapped, or robbed, or something. A stupid story, an old story. And now he goes to see that Willems and nothing. Comes back talking big about his prisoner. But after all he said very little. What did that Willems tell him? What passed between them? The old fellow must have had something in his mind when he let that scoundrel off. And Joanna. She would get round the old fellow. Sure. Then he would forgive perhaps. Impossible. But at any rate he would waste a lot of money on them. The old man was tenacious in his hates, but also in his affections. He had known that beast Willems from a boy. They would make it up in a year or so. Everything is possible. Why did he not rush off at first and kill the brute? That would have been more like Lingard. Almayer laid down his spoon suddenly, and pushing his plate away, threw himself back in the chair. Unsafe. Decidedly unsafe. He had no mind to share Lingard's money with anybody. Lingard's money was Nina's money in a sense. And if Willems managed to become friendly with the old man it would be dangerous for him, Almayer. Such an unscrupulous scoundrel. He would oust him from his position. He would lie and slander. Everything would be lost. Lost. Poor Nina. What would become of her? Poor child. for her sake he must remove that Willems. Must. But how? Lingard wanted to be obeyed. Impossible to kill Willems. Lingard might be angry. Incredible, but so it was. He might. A wave of heat passed through Almayer's body, flushed his face, and broke out of him in copious perspiration. He wriggled in his chair, and pressed his hands together under the table. What an awful prospect! He fancied he could see Lingard and Willems reconciled, and going away arm in arm, leaving him alone in this godforsaken hole in Samber in this deadly swamp. And all his sacrifices, the sacrifice of his independence, of his best years, his surrender to Lingard's fancies and caprices, would go for nothing. Horrible. Then he thought of his little daughter, his daughter. And the ghastliness of his supposition overpowered him. He had a deep emotion, a sudden emotion, that made him feel quite faint at the idea of that young life spoiled before it had fairly begun. His dear child's life. Lying back in his chair, he covered his face with both his hands. Ally glanced down at him and said, unconcernedly, "Aster finish?" Almayer was lost in the immensity of his commiseration for himself, for his daughter, who was perhaps not going to be the richest woman in the world notwithstanding Lingard's promises. He did not understand the other's question, and muttered through his fingers in a doleful tone, "What did you say? What? Finish what? Clear up, Misa," explained Ali. "Clear up?" burst out Almayer, with incomprehensible exasperation. "Evil take you and the table. Stupid. Chatterer. Shalaka. Get out." He leaned forward, glaring at his head man, then sank back in his seat with his arms hanging straight down on each side of the chair. And he sat motionless in a meditation so concentrated and so absorbing, with all his power of thought so deep within himself, that all expression disappeared from his face in an aspect of staring vacancy. Ally was clearing the table. He dropped negligently the tumbler into the greasy dish, flung there the spoon and fork, then slipped in the plate with a push amongst the remnants of food. He took up the dish, tucked up the bottle under his armpit, and went off. "My hammock!" shouted Almayer after him. "Ada! I come soon," answered Ally from the doorway in an offended tone, looking back over his shoulder. How could he clear the table, and hang the hammock at the same time? Yewa! Those white men were all alike. Wanted everything done at once. Like children. The indistinct murmur of his criticism went away, faded and died out together with the soft footfall of his bare feet in the dark passage. For some time Almayer did not move. His thoughts were busy at work shaping a momentous resolution, and in the perfect silence of the house he believed that he could hear the noise of the operation, as if the work had been done with a hammer. He certainly felt a thumping of strokes, faint, profound, and startling, somewhere low down in his breast, and he was aware of a sound of dull knocking, abrupt and rapid, in his ears. Now and then he held his breath, unconsciously, too long, and had to relieve himself by a deep expiration that whistled dully through his pursed lips. The lamp standing on the far side of the table threw a section of a lighted circle on the floor, where his outstretched legs stuck out from under the table with feet rigid, and turned up like the feet of a corpse, and his set face with fixed eyes would have been also like the face of the dead, but for its vacant yet conscious aspect, the hard, the stupid, the stony aspect of one not dead, but only buried under the dust, ashes, and corruption of personal thoughts, of base fears, of selfish desires. "I will do it." Not till he heard his own voice did he know that he had spoken. It startled him. He stood up. The knuckles of his hand, somewhat behind him, were resting on the edge of the table as he remained still with one foot advanced, his lips a little open, and thought, "It would not do to fool about with Lingard. But I must risk it. It's the only way I can see. I must tell her. She has some little sense. I wish they were 1,000 miles off already. 100,000 miles. I do. And if it fails. And she blabs out then to Lingard? She seemed a fool. No, probably they will get away. And if they did, would Lingard believe me? Yes. I never lied to him. He would believe. I don't know. Perhaps he won't. Must do it. Must. He argued aloud to himself. For a long time he stood still, looking before him with an intense gaze, a gaze rapt and immobile, that seemed to watch the minute quivering of a delicate balance, coming to a rest. To the left of him, in the whitewashed wall of the house, that formed the back of the veranda, there was a closed door. Black letters were painted on it proclaiming the fact that behind that door there was the office of Lingard & Company. The interior had been furnished by Lingard when he had built the house for his adopted daughter and her husband, and it had been furnished with reckless prodigality. There was an office desk, a revolving chair, bookshelves, a safe. All to humor the weakness of Elmer, who thought all those paraphernalia necessary to successful trading. Lingard had laughed, but had taken immense trouble to get the things. It pleased him to make his protege, his adopted son-in-law, happy. It had been the sensation of Samber some 5 years ago. While the things were being landed, the whole settlement literally lived on the river bank in front of the Rajalot's house, to look, to wonder, to admire. What a big mesa, with many boxes, fitted all over it and under it. What did the white man do with such a table? And look, look, oh brothers! There is a green square box, with a gold plate on it, a box so heavy that those 20 men cannot drag it up the bank. Let us go, brothers, and help pull at the ropes, and perchance we may see what's inside. Treasure, no doubt. Gold is heavy and hard to hold, oh brothers! Let us go, and earn a recompense from the fierce Raja of the Sea who shouts over there, with a red face. See, there is a man carrying a pile of books from the boat. What a number of books! What were they for? And an old invalided Jurumudi, who had traveled over many seas, and had heard holy men speak in far-off countries, explained to a small knot of unsophisticated citizens of Samber that those books were books of magic, that guides the white men's ships over the seas, that gives them their wicked wisdom and their strength. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.